Hey, welcome back to another week of Fox on Sports. I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And we are back here in the studio again. Very exciting. We will be at the Bedford High Gym tonight, which is Friday night. I do this same thing every week and it drives me nuts. Tonight is Friday night. However, you won't be listening to the show until Saturday, so where we are tonight really means nothing to you.
Hopefully you watched the game last night or went to the game or listened to it. If not, you can probably find it on demand.
Yes, you can find it on demand later. We won't give you any scores because we don't have them yet because the game hasn't ended. But the game or the, I guess, your update on Bedford High Athletics right now. Hockey, a loss to Pinkerton last Saturday, 3-2. There was a little bit of confusion on the part of the general public as to the team that was run out there by the Bedford hockey team to start the game. They wound up losing, like I said, 3-2, but they gave up 2 goals in 5 minutes. There were some guys that were sitting at the beginning of the game, but if you are a coach and you are going to teach some kind of a lesson, the time to do it is the middle of the season.
That's right. Yeah.
You don't win a championship in the middle of the season.
Right, you can't win it with a win in the middle of the season, but with lessons taught, lessons learned,
yes,
you can increase your odds of winning a championship at the end of the season.
Yes, so it is always a gamble, and it's always the kind of thing that if you are a coach and the general public is looking at you and saying, well, why did he do this? Why didn't he throw his best guys out there to start the game? A coach as experienced as Marty Myers has the reasons for doing why he does what he does. They lost 3-2. They came back, beat Concord 2-1. Parker Roberto, a goal and an assist. And Jake San Clemente also scored. Bedford with that 2-1 win over Concord. That was back Wednesday night at Concord's Everett Arena. Jake San Clemente is one of my favorite sports names, by the way. It's like Rex Orange County.
Who's that?
He's a YouTube musician, basically, who's independent. He hasn't signed a recording contract. But I'm a Southern California guy, which is really no secret to anybody. Every time I hear the name Jake San Clemente, it reminds me of San Clemente, California, which is self-proclaimed the best climate on earth, which I'm not wearing them today, but is also home of the best sandal factory on earth, the Rainbow Sandal Factory. Yeah, so it is a must stop if you're going on the 5 South, exit Avenue to Pico. And it's your second light on the left is the Sandal Factory. It is the Rainbow Sandal Mecca. In fact, I pray that direction every night.
Put this important sandals. Put this episode somewhere where you can access it quickly the next time you're in Southern California.
Yes, exactly. There's also a Del Taco off that exit as well as a Rubio's Fish Taco. So it really has everything that you could possibly need or imagine. So anyway, regardless of my proclivities for good fast food, and good Mexican food, which I did eat that last night, but that's a story for another day. The boys split the loss to Pinkerton last Saturday and then beat Concord 2-1 on Wednesday. The girls hockey team lost 7-3 to Pinkerton. I'm going to steal the joke from Runaway Bulldog. I'll give you one guess who scored all 3 goals for Bedford.
Maddie, Luke, and Tony.
There you go.
She scores in threes a lot.
Yeah, seriously. Maddie had the hat trick in the loss, so we will keep you updated as everybody starts rolling into the playoffs, which are later on this month. And I can say that now because we are officially in February. On the basketball side, the hardwood, the girls beat Central 59-45 after absolutely shellacking Alvern. And Bedford got 3 3-pointers from Allie. She scored 16. Isabella King scored 9 in the second quarter, 13 overall. And Kendi Barnard scored 11. So some nice and well-distributed scoring from the Bulldogs now. And the impressive thing you see, because we've watched a lot of girls' games, of course, a lot of teams really like to shoot threes. The percentage of makes on the threes, like as you and I have talked about, we talked about it the other night, 3 is more than 2 because that's how math works. It's 50% more. But if your shooting percentage is 25% from there and 50% from anywhere else, there's no point in shooting them because you're just wasting possessions, basically, unless you have somebody great down low. When Bedford is able to go against Central and hit a total of 7 threes, okay, now it makes sense to be behind the three-point line and shooting from out there.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the 50% baseline for two-point shooting, then what you want to do is shoot at least 33% from three-point land.
Yep.
And that's not too difficult to do for the good shooters. I mean, if you go all the way up to the NBA, you see a lot of guys shooting above 40%.
Yes.
And really the worst shooters shoot 32 to 33%. I mean, the coaches are advanced enough to look at the numbers and have enough repetitions to say, if you're not shooting that percentage, you shouldn't be shooting at all.
Right. Just don't.
So most guys are shooting more like 36, 37%. And so that's why analytically all the teams are saying, yeah, let's shoot these, because the guys who are shooting inside the three-point line are not shooting over 50%.
Right.
You get maybe a handful per conference, you know, the big guys who mostly only dunk or shoot layups. You'll have a handful of guys who are shooting around 60% on twos, but the vast majority of them are shooting overall shooting percentages of less than 50%.
Right.
That's why the three-point shot is such a weapon.
It is certainly a weapon, but another thing that's a weapon is defense. And we saw that the other night. The Bulldogs boys team, we were out there at the gym against Central that night. The boys lost 66-52, but it wasn't until we got to the end of the game and we're recapping it that we realized Bedford hadn't scored for a while. The Bulldogs in the last 5:40 were outscored 17-0. So they were up 52-49 at that point. And by way of a number of turnovers and some really stifling defense on the part of the Central Little Green, the Bulldogs kind of faltered down the stretch. And certainly something that when you and I looked at that team at the beginning of the season, and they really seemed to be clicking. They had a lot of the guys who played on the football team who were playing well and seemed to really just kind of, everybody sort of seemed to know what everybody else was doing. And they all just looked very comfortable. They're at a point now that I don't think either of us really expected. They're heading into game number 10 tonight, and they just looked out of sync on Tuesday night.
Yeah, they did. And you got to give a lot of credit to Central. Those guys defensively, it was just like a wave of defenders. Like Bedford would cross half court, and then it was just this energy that was just pushing seemingly from every direction towards the other end. And it was just two guys swarming on the ball, guys closing down passing lanes, and they just kept forcing turnover after turnover. They did well in transition. And, you know, the wild card, we mentioned it on the broadcast, was this Jesus Milan just had an incredible game. He just uses athleticism to create havoc, both on the perimeter, creating turnovers, in the post, rebounds, steals, blocks. And, he was just the X factor in that loss.
It was interesting to see Milan, too. He was playing good defense and really capitalizing in transition, too, where he's a forward. He wasn't getting caught down low. He was getting a lot of fast break baskets, so he was breaking out nicely on that fast break. But the one that we saw for Central, I think, that I was probably most impressed by was that sophomore guard, Royce Williams, who wound up scoring 23 in the game, was hitting threes, looked like he had a little bit of jitters early on, but once he sort of got his bearings and realized that he could control the game a bit more, he really became a big factor in the game. So the real trick for Bedford is ultimately going to be trying to figure out who are the most trustworthy ball handlers. And we saw some guys come in and play what I would consider to be significant minutes that we hadn't seen earlier in the season, or that you hadn't seen as much of. Connor Butts, Jordan Dyer were two that were getting some playing time and were called upon to push the ball up the floor and really play almost the true point guard spot. But Bedford's going to need to also get some more production from those forwards too.
Yeah, and Trey Ravenel has had a great season from what we've seen. In this last game, it didn't seem like he got as many touches as he had recently. So he wasn't as much of an offensive force, but that's no fault to him. I just think Bedford didn't get him the ball enough and in the right spots. And so he's one of those forwards, especially when you talk about the bench group, where you got to have somebody coming off the bench who's going to provide that scoring punch.
Yep.
And he's the one who's most able to do that and has done that most often so far. So you got to make sure you get the ball to him in the post. And that was the thing we talked about, was a lot of those turnovers happened on the perimeter on the first or second pass of the possession before they could even get the ball into the post to Trey.
Right, and it was also made difficult by the fact that Central really locked down on Justin O'Neill. In the second half. He had 16 in the first. We've been calling him a point forward because he is. He really is that threat to shoot from outside. He's 6'7". He's got the wingspan, so he's nice to use down low, but you don't need him down there because he's effective from outside, and hopefully you get a mismatch here and there. Central did a really nice job of making an adjustment, shutting O'Neill down in the second half, and ultimately that, for them, made a big difference in the game because it wasn't like you could look at O'Neill and say, well, he just went cold. He just wasn't getting the shots.
Yeah, he was playing the point forward in the first half, and for the game, he made 4 3-pointers. So I thought it was his best perimeter game of the season, and he was not only hitting those threes from the perimeter, but he was also driving to the basket. So he was using that sort of dual threat action, and that's why he was so hard to defend in the first half. Second half, you're right, they just did a better job of kind of clamping down the middle of the court, funneling everything to the outside, and he was no longer on the top of the key with a one-on-one situation.
He was
getting the ball on the wing or not even getting the ball on the wing because Central had come up with another steal.
Yep. So Bedford ultimately wound up losing that one 66-52. They fall to 4-5 on the season, play Goffstown tonight, which is Friday. And then the girls will take their 7-2 record against Goffstown at home tonight as well. So we'll have an update on everything that that has transpired in next week's show as well. Now, in the NBA, it's amazing for the New York Knicks how things change so rapidly. And in their case, it went from earlier in the day, Kristaps Porzingis walking in and saying, I don't like the culture here and I'd like to be traded, to a deal being consummated by the end of the day.
Yeah, that really happened quickly.
Right.
And what a blockbuster trade. You know, Porzingis being traded is something that had been talked about. Last summer it was talked about. You know, new coach coming in, Fizdale. He goes over to Europe to meet with Porzingis to try to build a relationship. Porzingis is, of course, injured, so he's trying to lay the foundation for a relationship with the franchise player so that when he comes back healthy, they're ready to hit the ground running. And then sort of you didn't hear much about it. And apparently in the last couple of weeks, the Knicks had started to wonder, is Porzingis committed to us long term? And so they had actually started to talk to other teams about trades, but it just didn't happen publicly like it has with Anthony Davis. So the way the news came out, you're right, there was that news of, hey, Porzingis just told us he's not happy. And then by the end of the day, we've got this blockbuster trade with Dallas. So it looked like quite a whirlwind.
And it's also weird. It's and you know that I have this Deadspin addiction that occasionally rears its ugly head. And occasionally I will, like, do nothing except get all my sports news from there. And then I realize that it's really not a terribly reliable source and not a good place for me to be. And then I go away from it for a while. There's a tag that they use. They'll file stories under things that they tag. And one of them is LOL Mets. Because usually if there's a story involving the Mets, it's something where something is happening to a player or in the front office. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it can only be the Mets. Like, it just works out that way. The Knicks are the Mets of the NBA, but without a foil of the Yankees. And it's amazing when you look at it. Like, the Knicks back in the 70s and 90s or 80s too, were really, I'm not going to say they were a model franchise. They've always been kind of a step below. But in the last 5 or 6 years, the Knicks have been a complete and utter mess to a point now where, like, they reached out to the Pelicans to talk about Anthony Davis in a trade, and the Pelicans just kind of went, nah, we're all set.
Right, because they nobody was sure if Porzingis would want to stay
right
in New Orleans. But you're right. I think it was 1973, the last time the Knicks won the NBA championship, and they had Ewing in the 80s and 90s, so they were always relevant and competitive. They got to the NBA Finals, lost to the Rockets. But in the last 15 years, they have really been an absolute mess.
Yeah, I mean, at the points in time in the 80s and 90s, you had Ewing, you had Grandmama, you had John Starks. Like, you had Oakley. You had, like, really good and fun Knicks teams. And it's gone from that to nobody really wants to play there. They've set themselves up in a situation now where they'll have $71 million in cap space this summer, but you're not going to have Kevin Durant signing with the Knicks. Like,
well, that's their path. That's their ideal goal. That's
okay,
their dream.
My ideal goal is to win the lottery. I mean, is that bad?
Well, that's what...
I mean, that's what I want. Like, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen.
Right. Well, the thing with signing a star like Durant, obviously, you only need two people to agree. You need the Knicks owner or general manager and then the player. And the reports in the last 24 hours are suggesting that the Knicks must have some sort of understanding with an agent or a player that he's going to come sign there this summer. Otherwise, why would you do this deal? Because
I just don't know. I think it might be a combination. Well, and you know the NBA better than I do. Was there a trading deadline yesterday?
It's next Thursday.
Okay, so if you're the Knicks, you don't have to. This guy's not playing anytime soon. He's coming back from ACL surgery. So it's not like you have to, like, all right, we have to deal this guy because it's the trade deadline. And he walked in and said, no me gusta, I'm out. And, like, we need to get rid of him. There's really no reason that he walks in on a Thursday and you deal him by the end of the day. Like, unless you go, God, I don't think we're going to get anything better for him than Dennis Smith Jr. and a couple of other parts. And these two draft picks, and who knows, maybe the Mavs said, hey, this is what we got. Take it or leave it. Like, we're out. And the Knicks, I will say this to their credit, realized that Mark Cuban really likes Eastern European players.
Yep.
Because he seems to think that they come out as more of a fully formed diamond than players that come through the American AAU/1 year of college system. So Cuban likes the way that that's set up. But the funny thing is, for every Eastern European player that has been very successful in the NBA, I feel like there are two or three that have come in as can't miss and have just blown up, and not in a good way. Darko is one. But there are no shortage of those guys either. Cuban now has two. He has Luka Doncic and he's got Porzingis on the team. And I do think you could really build a nice core with those guys. And that will be interesting to see. But really, I don't know if you're the Knicks, why you take this guy who is nicknamed and is a unicorn. I don't know why you take this guy and just say, okay, he walked in, we got to deal him today.
Yeah, I really don't think that was necessary. I mean, you have another week to work the phones, and I have to think there's a better trade out there because of looking at the Knicks roster. They didn't need another point guard. They don't really need Dennis Smith Jr. If he turns out to be an all-star, great. But they already traded for Emmanuel Mudiay. They've got Frank Ntilikina, who they drafted say that five times fast.
Frank the Tank. Somebody referred to him in the Deadspin comments as Frank the Tank, and that's fine with me. That works.
In the 2017 draft, when Phil Jackson was still in charge, they drafted Ntilikina 8th overall.
Yep.
Dennis Smith Jr. went 9th to the Mavericks.
Right.
So the Knicks had their chance at Dennis Smith Jr. All they had to do was spend their first-round draft pick on him. Now they've traded the unicorn to get him. And so it's a mess. With that in hindsight, knowing that they could have had him so easily. So getting back to their roster, they've got Ntilikina, they've got Emmanuel Mudiay, they've got this guy Alonzo Trier who's been playing some point. So they're
the only player from the Pac-12 to be making any kind of an impact this year, yes.
So now they've got a glutton of point guards, and what else do they have? They've got Kevin Knox, who they just drafted, nice young player, but that's pretty much it. And so to your point about, all right, we've got $71 million this summer, who's actually going to come sign here? It's got to be somebody who really wants to be in New York, and if there are two stars who want to play together, they know that they can go team up in New York. And yes, there's some allure to playing there and to being the guys who bring championship glory back to the Knicks, but they're so far away from that.
That's the thing. It's like people talk about Boston media getting annoyed with athletes who don't perform up to expectations fast. And I will agree, the Boston media is gross when it comes to that stuff. Like, if you don't do like JD Martinez does the first month of the season, you might as well just pack up your stuff and go. I mean, David Price, by most standards, has been a very good signing. But you wouldn't know it from listening to Boston talk radio. And thankfully, I don't. I just get like the random bits and pieces of things. But the media is very tough. I think New York media is even worse, where you go there and you start out and you have a couple bad games. Let's say you run into a couple bad matchups. All of a sudden, people, why did we sign this guy? He was so good somewhere else. And then you start circling the drain. Like, you're in this downward spiral and you have to pull yourself out. That, to me, is one of the most difficult and least palatable things about playing in New York, is that. Just the fact that you have to deal with the media and really completely unjustified expectations. Because, like you said, 15 years since the Knicks have really been relevant. Like, there's no reason that anybody should have any expectations. They should be happy with 41-41. The only thing, really, that the Knicks have going for them, in my opinion, is David Fizdale.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, he seems to be a player's coach.
Player's coach, knowledgeable, just overall. He seems like he'd be fun to play for, just a good dude.
Just hasn't worked out so well with Enes Kanter and him. But back to Porzingis for another minute. If you rewind the clock to this summer when there was talk about, will they actually trade Porzingis? What would it take? And you'd hear what they would demand from the Celtics, were, you know, 2 first-round picks and Tatum and Brown. Like the kind of package that they might put together for Anthony Davis. That's what makes you wonder, why did they settle for Dennis Smith Jr. and 2 draft picks? You know, I think the timing is just a little bit off, because I think what they're hoping is that they have this sort of Celtics-Brooklyn Nets trade where they get these 2 or 3 first-round picks, and boy, they're going to be great picks. And, you know, within 5 years, we'll be a championship-level contender. But that's what needs to take place before the free agents are going to want to come, because we don't know what those draft picks are going to be in 2021 and 2023. And the only other thing the Knicks have going for them is their draft pick this year. So if they end up winning the lottery, you mentioned the lottery, then maybe they get Zion, and then they're going to bank on the star free agents wanting to come and play with Dennis Smith Jr. and Zion, which I think is possible, but I don't think it's going to happen if they don't get that number one pick. So just quite a gamble to trade Porzingis, who's such a valuable asset, to just get a point guard and 2 draft picks coming 3 and 5 years down the road. But from Dallas's perspective, like you said, what an exciting pairing with Luka Doncic and Porzingis. That is a pairing that you can build around for the next decade. And I think Cuban has got to be psyched with this trade. Not to mention they get Tim Hardaway Jr., who's a very talented wing player. And then you've already got Harrison Barnes. You've got the veteran Dirk Nowitzki there to be the mentor for these new European stars. And he's just going to pass the torch. So I think Cuban is just got to be ecstatic today with this trade.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how it plays out. Of course, the Knicks have had a long history of doing ridiculous things, and it appears that they've just added one more to the list. So,
what do you think about? I wanted to talk to you about the Anthony Davis situation, because
yes,
that was, you know, stealing all the headlines from the Super Bowl earlier this week until this Porzingis trade, but this is really the potential transaction that's going to change the landscape of the NBA, because you've got the 2 best franchises in the NBA historically, the Celtics and the Lakers, seemingly fighting for his services. You know, they are the ones who have the best shot on paper of landing Anthony Davis after he made his trade demand public through his agent. But so there's the part about where's he going to end up, and that's fascinating. But to me, it's really fascinating to look at the motivations, the strategy, the leverage that's involved with what's happening with Anthony Davis. Because if you haven't heard, his agent is the same agent for LeBron. LeBron's on the Lakers. And so it seems that there's this strategy behind closed doors with Magic, LeBron's agent, to get Anthony Davis out to L.A. So how do we do it? So what they decide to do is a week before the trade deadline, after New Orleans has lost three in a row, they're out of the playoff picture. This is the time they strike and they say, all right, now it's going to make sense for Anthony Davis to say, I want to be out, because they're not right now. They're not in the playoff picture. So smart on their part to do it right then, because it makes a little bit more sense.
Yep.
Than if, you know, New Orleans was in fifth and they're right in the heart of the playoff race. Why do you want to leave, Anthony? You know, stay here and play this out with us and see what we can do. So that came together well for the strategy. But the other reason, of course, that they did it right now, a week before the trade deadline, is because they want to do this deal before the Celtics will get involved. And the media has been a little bit confusing about this. The Celtics can get involved. They can trade for him now if they trade Kyrie Irving. And so this goes back to the Rose Rule, and the, you know, because of them acquiring Kyrie Irving by trade and the type of extension he signed, they cannot acquire Anthony Davis by trade until this summer when Kyrie Irving's deal is over.
Yeah.
So the Lakers jump in and say, let's push this now. Let's try and be the only negotiator in the room before the trade deadline so that the Celtics can't get in the mix, because we know if the Celtics get in the mix this summer, whatever package they present to the Pelicans is going to be more enticing than what we have.
Right.
So they basically are saying to the Pelicans, you got to do this deal now, because we're the ones who have a great package available right now. You can have all of our young players, multiple draft picks, whoever you want, come and get them. And they know that with Anthony Davis telling other people, telling the world, I don't want to go re-sign with anybody else. So, yeah, you got New Orleans, you can wait for Boston's offer this summer, but I'm already telling everybody I want to go to the Lakers anyway. So why would you wait to get a lesser deal from the Celtics? It's going to be a rental when I'm just going to go sign with the Lakers anyway. So they're pushing everything in to the middle and saying, deal with us. It's your best option to get a good deal. And do this deal now so the Celtics can't get involved. I just think it was Magic's best move, and if it works out, it's going to be brilliant, but I don't know if it will.
I don't know. Here's the thing. I think Magic's best move was being host of the Magic Show on late night TV, first of all. We got to just get that straight. As we have seen in the last, 16 or 17 games that the Lakers played, their young players really aren't anything to write home about. They are, if you take, they were in fourth in the West when LeBron hurt his groin. Now they're in ninth in the West. I think they went 6-11 without LeBron. Sweet. So you can have all these young players, and then you too can win a whopping, 30-something percent of your games. Cool? I think if you're the Pelicans, you have to do what is best for your franchise, and what is best for your franchise isn't getting a bunch of ill-fitting parts together. I mean, just because, awesome. Let's say I, walk out to the back of a restaurant that does a brunch buffet and I pick a bunch of cantaloupe parts up that they've used and discarded and whatever. I can put all those together, but I can't get a cantaloupe out of it. I just have a bunch of cantaloupe parts.
You can't even get a good fruit salad out of
it. You can't even get anything. And so that's what the Lakers have. They have a bunch of cut-up cantaloupe parts, but you're not going to actually be able to make a cantaloupe with them. Like, they've done just a really weird job drafting. They fell into the whole Lonzo Ball is going to be the second coming of a lousy point guard with a bad shot. That's the first time I've said his name in a while. We were going through a regular thing. I haven't heard his dad's name in even longer, which is good. I'm not going to say it. But I think if you are the Pelicans and you're like, hey, we can make a deal in the summer that's going to set us up for the next year or the next years, I think your better bet is to deal with the Celtics and get some legitimately polished young players who might need a little bit more of the spotlight than they've been able to get. So that, to me, would be a logical thing for the Pelicans to do. They're just going to have to basically deal with this like the Spurs dealt with Kawhi at the end of last year. I don't like this. I don't know how else to say it. I just don't like it. Like, I get not wanting to play somewhere. We talked about this on text. I don't get not wanting to play in New Orleans. Like, if I could play anywhere in the NBA, that would be the place that I would play.
Yeah, but we got to remember what he's gone through. He's been there his whole career. He's been a great teammate, model citizen, player. And look where they've gone. Pretty much nowhere. I mean, last year they won a playoff series, so they're trending in the right direction. But then the team doesn't re-sign DeMarcus Cousins. They don't re-sign Rondo, who he played well with and liked. And so those two things, I think, really contributed to this a lot, because that was the thing last year, is imagine what the possibilities are with DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis playing together. It's the type of 1-2 punch that maybe the Warriors will have trouble with.
Yeah.
And then you throw in veteran players like Rondo, who make those guys better. And then Jrue Holiday, who's a great two-way player. That's an awesome nucleus.
Yeah, I don't know. You know more because you follow it more closely than I do. Why didn't they sign Cousins even to that, you know?
Well, he wanted a massive deal. He wanted, you know, 3 years, $30 million per. And they were... Coming off a torn Achilles. And obviously he's going to miss half this season like he did. They didn't want to commit that much money to him without knowing how he's going to be physically. And I think it was probably Dell Demps, the general manager, kind of thinking, you know, my job might be at stake here. Do I want to commit all that money to him? And then if he doesn't play well next year, you know, maybe I lose my job because we invested so much in Cousins. And with a big player like that coming off of Achilles, it was risky. And so I think it was maybe that influencing the decision. And no, I mean, no other team offered him 3 years and $30 million. So, you know, it makes sense. But the Warriors got him for $6 million on a one-year deal.
Yeah, and that was a steal. I wonder if that might not be one of the ones that would be a potential Nick boogie.
Yeah, could be.
So, all right, so we've been talking about the NBA for a really long time, particularly the Anthony Davis thing and that. You have a thing about buzzer shots.
I do.
Is this a Hanson thing, or is this like a known issue?
It's just, I mean, I want to give you the update because we talked about it recently. It's just something that has been building with me. It's been brewing, because if you pay close attention, you will hear it at every level, and a lot at the NBA, where they joke about it. You know, they joke about the guy, oh, just, yeah, he shot it after the buzzer. That's when you should shoot the half-court shot, because that way it doesn't hurt your shooting percentage. And it just bothers me. I just think it's completely backwards. I think it's the wrong mentality. I don't think it's the right message to send to young players. What is the purpose of the strategy and the game? Obviously, you're trying to win, and that's not the only thing that matters in basketball, obviously, with athletics. But one of the main focuses is trying to win the game and score more points than the opponent. So why would you
play to win the game?
Why would you avoid taking a shot that could get you 3 points, especially when you are a star? So Kevin Durant, for those who watched the Celtics-Warriors game about a week ago, what a terrific game that was. It was Saturday night, right? So just after we'd done our show, and at the end of the first quarter, Durant has the ball at half court, and he just takes his time, lets the buzzer go off, and then half a second later shoots it from half court, and he makes it. And it doesn't count, and he doesn't care. He didn't try to shoot it before the buzzer. And what a perfect example. I mean, this is Kevin Durant. Like, if his shooting percentage goes from 38% to 34% from three, is he going to lose any money for it? No. He's going to get a max deal if he wants it, wherever he wants it.
Right. I was going to say, he's not losing any money for anything. He's Kevin Durant.
There's no downside.
Somebody will offer him money.
So there is zero downside to him shooting these shots and it lowering his shooting percentage. And oh, by the way, he made it. And oh, by the way, it was a one possession game.
Yeah.
So do you think they could have used those 3 points? So it just really bothers me that a guy like Kevin Durant will not take that shot. And then during the middle of the week, we got to give props to Ben Simmons, because he attempted his first three-pointer of the season in this scenario in Denver. End of the third quarter, he shoots one from half court. It was his first attempted three-pointer of the season.
Yep.
And so we got to give him props, and at the same time question why he hasn't developed his shot more, that he can't shoot a three-pointer, he can't shoot a free throw. So,
because the Sixers can't draft anybody that doesn't have some sort of wart.
Yeah, seriously. And then to finish off the story, last night, Golden State in a close game with Philly, end of the first half, Steph is five. He hit his first five three-pointers, and now he's 5 for 6, coming down to the buzzer. He shoots one from over half court, just barely misses. And at the time, I think Golden State was up by maybe 7 or 8. So certainly didn't need to. You know, you think, oh, we're going to go ahead and cruise ahead and win this game. But they end up losing the game. And so that really could have mattered. And Steph, you know, he's confident enough in himself and his shooting percentage where he's like, you know, even though we're up 7, I need to take this because then we go up 10. Maybe we have the momentum and we win. And so hats off to Steph Curry and to Ben Simmons, not so much to Kevin Durant. And I just hope that the young players out there will watch a guy like Steph Curry and model his actions.
So there you go. Kids, shoot the ball at the buzzer. We'll take a quick break. Come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
I was wondering if you were going to catch on to that. You just sent me something. What did you send me?
Playoff stats for the Rams and Patriots.
Okay. So we'll talk about that in a second. I'm like, this is like the agate type from a sports page. It's like a throwback to the days when I used to sit there and pore over the box scores.
It's a thing called a newspaper.
I know. It's weird. It's
fun to look at, isn't it?
Right. It really, you know, back before we all carried our phones in our pockets, do you remember like the mad scamper to pick up the sports page before you went to do your business?
Yeah. Or before breakfast.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. The sports page. It's just a throwback to a bygone time. Like I do miss sitting there and like you'd look and you know what the columns were for baseball is like at bats, runs, hits, runs batted in. And you'd see like, whoever, I'll throw it out from the 80s, like I'd see it in California. Fred Lynn, 4 at-bats, 3 runs scored, 3 hits, 6 driven in. And you're like, boy, you must have had a game last night. But there was nobody on TV to tell you that he had a great game because, like, or let's say he's playing for the Sox. All they're talking about out there is the Dodgers and then kind of a little bit their little brother, the Angels. And that was it. So, I guess if we're talking about the Dodgers, I would be remiss. It was a big day in our house yesterday, Jackie Robinson's 100th birthday.
That's right.
So it's a big deal, obviously. Jackie Robinson, the one who broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. We've spent a lot of time talking about Dirty Al Gallagher, the old manager that I worked with in Kansas City years ago, who managed in the minor leagues for about 1,000 years. And Al played on the San Francisco Giants in the 70s with Willie Mays, who a lot of people, if you talk to, will consider to be the best baseball player of all time. And so Al was there, I think, early 70s with Willie. And he said that the only time that Willie did not rule the roost is if Jackie Robinson walked into the clubhouse. That was the only guy who would kind of, I don't think really in any sort of a menacing way, but just a reverential way more than anything else. He would walk in and Willie Mays was kind of like nodding his head yes, because how can you not be? And I think we all talk about it. And all right, he broke into Major League Baseball, 72 years ago? So he was 28 years old. I think now, as much as you might look at things that go on in the country and say, we have a long way to go, and we still have a long way to go, he was the only. And the pressure of playing Major League Baseball and being what many perceived as a standard bearer for your ethnicity, I just can't even imagine the pressure of doing that day in and day out. And he did it as a complete and utter gentleman.
It's incredible. I mean, he's an icon. He's a hero. And I even heard on a basketball broadcast this week, it should be a national holiday. I mean, I think it was Kevin Harlan who said it.
I mean, Kevin Harlan's a stud. Yeah, he's good.
While we're talking about Lawrence and this day, I got to say happy birthday to my grandpa. Yesterday was his 96th birthday. So he's 4 years Jackie Robinson's junior. Still here.
Seriously.
Still doing great. So happy birthday, Grandpa. And, you know, he's one who's lived through that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he would tell you, I mean, the guy's a hero. He really is.
It's amazing. Jackie Robinson passed away, and it's funny, if Maggie was sitting here, we could be interviewing her because she would know the details. He died in 1972 at the age of 53, diabetes, which he had had for a long time, ultimately a heart attack. But if you look at pictures of Jackie in later life, he had strikingly gray hair. And a lot of people will tell you that the ordeal of breaking into Major League Baseball prematurely aged him. His wife, Rachel, or his widow, Rachel, is 96 years old. And I have not seen any public sightings of Rachel. Like, there hasn't really been a whole lot in the way of mentions. She's 96. I remember seeing her in her 80s and utterly striking, beautiful, like, didn't look like she was in her 80s. And, you know, I think about, and I've talked about this a little bit in the past, how fortunate I was to grow up as a Dodger fan and to basically get to live a dream of, I had an older sister that was working in their front office, and the guys that would parade into the office, you know, Don Newcomb was the head of the Speakers Bureau. He won Cy Young Award in 1956, a notable pitcher for the Dodgers then. Roy Campanella was at just about every game in his wheelchair. His wife, Roxy, was with him a lot of the time. Sweet Lou Johnson, who, you know, played in the Negro Leagues. He was one of the, I believe he was the last player active in the major. No, that's not right. He was the last Negro Leagues player, I believe, to be signed out of the Negro Leagues and play in the major leagues. But Sweet Lou was one of the guys on the Speakers Bureau, and I used to sit there, and he used to let me have part of his desk while my sister was making me do something to occupy me for a little bit. You know, it's because you're 13 years old and she doesn't want to just let you wander around the stadium. But these guys were like a history book come to life. Like, I was 13 or 14 and I got to interview Don Newcomb for a report that I was doing on Jackie Robinson. Like, who gets to do that? Like, you talk about just getting lucky. But Jackie Robinson, to put him into some kind of a context, and this is all from people were writing some good articles yesterday. At UCLA, a scoring champion in basketball, averaged 20 yards a punt return, 12 yards a carry on the football field, was an NCAA long jump champion in track. He only hit 097 in his one season of baseball at the Bruins. He earned varsity letters in four sports. In college, like, this isn't like a small high school. This is like as much as it pains me to say it, a legit school. This is UCLA.
Oh, mark this down. Mark this day down again.
His first professional contract was with the Kansas City Monarchs in 1945. He got a tryout for the Red Sox in 1945, but it was set up for political purposes. He knew that the team was wasting their time. There were a lot of Negro League players, Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, upset that they got passed over for Jackie. I remember that being a big part of the Satchel Paige Don't Look Back movie with Lou Gossett Jr., that he and Lahoma were upset that he hadn't been the guy. He in his first game playing AAA in Jersey City, 4-for-5 with a homer and scored 4 runs. So it was kind of, you knew he was going to do it. Then he led the Royals to the International League pennant and the Little World Series title. And you would have to figure there are many more people who would say they were there. Only 26,000 people were at his debut at Ebbets Field. It's the numbers, and there's an interesting thing from Bill James that I actually took a picture of and I promise I'll stop boring you with Jackie Robinson facts. But, like, he's one of those people that if I could find a way to meet the guy, obviously he's been dead for longer than I've been alive. If I could find a way to meet the guy, I mean, just the things that he had seen and the thoughts that must have gone through his head are just astonishing.
Yeah, what he had to go through.
So Bill James, as he's writing in the Historical Baseball Abstract, is talking about fielders. And he says, about Jackie. He says, also, Jackie was, according to all accounts, unusually intelligent. Is it not possible, I wonder, that Jackie's intelligence created benefits for his team that only show up in the stats? I've made this argument before, and I don't want to repeat myself, but if an infielder makes a diving stop of a line drive, he wins recognition as a defensive wizard, Derek Jeter. But if he anticipates the play and moves two steps to his left before he goes after it, it is a routine play and nobody notices. Invisible range, I call it. Anticipating the play creates invisible range. Isn't it possible that Jackie just anticipated the play more often than anybody else did? Before you answer that, let me point out a couple other things. What position, I'm asking you a question, what position is he to you?
Second base.
Okay, great. He played first base in the majors. That's where he broke in. He played second. He played third. He played the outfield. Before you answer that, let me point out a couple other things. Jackie also played about 2,000 innings at third base at the end of his career. Guess what? As a third baseman, he rates as even more sensational than he was as a second baseman. The average at third base post-1940 is 3.22 win shares per 1,000 innings. The highest figure since 1940 by a player who's played 10,000 or more innings is 4.97 by Cleet Boyer. Jackie is at 5.52. He is off the charts. Nobody else post-1940 is even in the same zone. Just to complete the record, and as an outfielder, he rates the same. He was a corner guy, left or right. He rates the same as an outfielder as guys like Roberto Clemente, a little bit ahead of guys like Dwight Evans and Al Kaline, Minnie Minoso. So these are old baseball names. Just to complete the record, I don't have him rated as a top-flight defensive first baseman. The position he played when he was breaking into the league. He played about 1,665 innings at first base, rating just a little above average. Still, I think the record would suggest that Robinson may, in fact, have been a far better defensive player than most people think he was. If it is a statistical illusion of some kind, it's an illusion that chases him all over the diamond. Never underestimate the power of intelligence, particularly when that intelligence is combined with athletic ability, determination, and a formidable competitive instinct. So he's just one of those dudes who was smart. I mean, I'm sitting in the room with one of them. Very smart, but also very competitive and knew how to use his brain to help him win.
Yeah, I mean, that last statement from Bill James is just perfect. The intelligence, the determination, the competitive spirit. And that I also love that line about if it was some sort of anomaly, it followed him all across the field.
It's so just bizarre.
Maybe it was more than just a coincidence.
Yeah. I actually, on a complete aside, on this list, it says he left baseball to become the vice president of New York coffee chain, chock full of nuts, which made him the first African-American vice president of corporation in U.S. history. It also made it so that my older daughter made me buy Chock Full of Nuts coffee one day at the grocery store years ago. So, but happy birthday to Jackie Robinson and an understated, truly great American. And he, in doing so, paved the way for the next guy we're going to talk about, Deion Sanders.
That's right.
ESPN rolled out that 30 for 30 about Deion. And
last night, they probably did it for that reason.
Maybe. Really? Right? Was it last night?
It was last night.
It's something to watch.
Thursday.
And it was interesting. The guy they had narrating it was Ludacris.
Right.
Which I thought was really cool. But you watch that. And you realize, okay, we're talking about Jackie playing four sports. Well, Deion probably could have lettered in three, if not, I mean, he was by all accounts a great basketball player too. But to be able to hit 533 in the World Series while you're still a part of an NFL team, it's just astonishing. And you and I talked about this earlier. As much as people now want to say the media is so bad and they'll always find a negative spin on everything. Well, this was 1992, and you have a guy doing something that every red-blooded American male would have given their kidneys and probably a limb to be able to do, playing in the World Series and playing for an NFL team in the same day, and the media is just all over him for it.
What a shame, because
it was so cool.
It was a phenomenal accomplishment, a phenomenal documentary. And that's one of the things that really stood out to me was Deion saying this should have been a celebration, an amazing time, but it wasn't for those reasons. He was getting so much grief from team management and media, and it's just it's just such a shame because he was, you know, talking about Jackie Robinson's competitive drive. He was doing everything he could to help two teams in the same city.
Yes.
Win.
Yes.
So why not celebrate the guy and cheer him along all the way from plane ride down to Miami, plane ride back to the baseball game? I mean, that's the mentality it should have been.
Yeah. It was an amazing feat to be able to do it. The guy, it's interesting. The point that was brought up was he didn't have a contract with the Braves to play after July 31st. They had a handshake deal that he was going to play. That was it.
And yet the Braves are all upset, all up in arms, because he would deign to go play football in the afternoon, and because the Falcons have one game a week, so he'll fly to Miami to play for his teammates in football and come back. Didn't miss a game.
Yeah.
He was there.
He did miss a game for the Falcons. He missed the game on October 18th, I think, because he kind of realized the amount of flack that he would get by missing, by just splitting it on the day of a World Series game. But you think about how petty the Braves were with that. He wound up hitting .533 in the World Series and played great defense. You know, making good catches, outs on the throwing guys out on the bases, and the Braves are throwing up Jeff Treadway to play in the game instead of Deion Sanders. Why? It just is. It's just this, you know. And there's always this constant battle between the unwritten rules guys and that's not how the game is played guys. And I get it. Like, I get that there is a certain decorum that you have to have, but there also needs to be a point in time where, I'll use Jose Bautista. You just hit a massive home run at home. I don't care if you do round off back handsprings out of the batter's box after you flip your bat. You just hit a big home run. And to go back to that era, the 93, when Jack Buck says, Joe Carter, touch them all, Joe, you'll never hit a bigger home run. Joe Carter has this ear-to-ear grin, and he's like, he looks like a little kid. And that's what everybody forgets is these are grown men, regardless whether it's football, baseball, basketball, they're playing a little boy's game. And to go back to the Dodgers and Roy Campanella, it's a game I don't remember the exact quote. It's you have to have a lot of little boy in you to play that game. You have to have enthusiasm. This is passion. This isn't, and no disrespect to lawyers or accountants, because you're one and I'm technically an accountant. You don't finish a case and then walk out with a file, spike the file and start doing the icky shuffle. Like, there are some things that you have to play with joy.
And isn't it funny that the only people who really understood it and had his back were his teammates?
Yes.
Terry Pendleton was interviewed.
Terry Pendleton was awesome.
Yeah, exactly. After the game, he said, no, there's no problem in this locker room. We're all for you, Deion. Go get him. Can't wait to have you back. And then Deion told the emotional story of he walks onto the bus and his Falcons teammates give him a standing ovation and it brought him to tears.
Yeah.
So his teammates had his back and they said, hey, we want you to help both teams. But, you know, the coaches, we take Jerry Glanville. He almost had it right for the Falcons. He seemed to be supportive of it, but then he had to bench him for the first play just to, you know, oh, because he wasn't here for practice. So I'm going to make a statement. And then, you know, the Braves guys were obviously upset, even though, as you pointed out, he wasn't even under contract with them. So they didn't have the right focus. And you mentioned the media, guys like Tim McCarver just trying to rip him to shreds and saying, where is his allegiance to his team? I mean, why isn't it not that he's got his allegiance to both teams and the city, and he's doing everything he could to try and help both teams win?
And he's doing, like, the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, seriously, the only blemish on Deion in the whole thing is when he got McCarver with the ice water. That is the only thing I find fault with. I understand why he did it. That's a tough thing to be in that situation when you should be happy and celebrating your team won the pennant And my first thought wouldn't be to go after the guy that has been excoriating me. Although to hear Deion talk about it, his mom would call him up after the games and say, Tim McCarver said blah, blah, blah about you. So you have to imagine that it was probably eating at the guy, and it was probably a little bit stressful. But he, if you haven't watched it, find it. It's really cool. And it was, it's really a lot of fun. I remember living it. I was, 18? And just, how cool is it? And how cool that we had him and Bo Jackson both doing it.
Yeah, really. And the back and forth and how they pushed each other. They had that game at Yankee Stadium where Bo hit three homers. Deion hit it inside the park homer.
That was cool. Bo separates his shoulder trying to make a catch on a ball that Deion hit. Deion rounds the bases, gets the inside the park home run, and they got four home runs between them that day.
Right. And you know what? I had forgotten seeing the old footage of Deion playing cornerback. His hands were incredible. He was making interceptions with one hand. Like, he had the soft hands of a Hall of Fame wide receiver. And that's one of the things that made him such a great cornerback, was he's able to make so many of those interceptions and turn them into return touchdowns. That wouldn't that just be amazing if more of the cornerbacks today, instead of having like these steel hands that they can't catch anything, that's why they're a cornerback, if they had the athleticism of Deion? I mean, that was just beautiful to watch, the way that he would play defense. And it's something we don't see today.
Well, and then also he goes from an LCS game down to Atlanta and plays, and not only is playing defense, but he's also, they're lining him up in the slot as a wide receiver.
Yeah, he caught a ball.
I know. I just stuff like
it raises the bar for everybody else.
Just cool. And I wish Kyler Murray wasn't a quarterback, because if Kyler Murray wasn't it's easier to be a part-time corner or a part-time running back,
right,
than it is to be a quarterback. The amount of film that you have to study in order to be an elite quarterback in the NFL, that really is a full-time job. And I think it would be next to impossible to say, hey, I'm going to get into the fall and I'm going to flex my time. You can't do that at that point. That's tough. But I'd love to be able to see him play both. I want my kids to be able to have the same joy that I did in watching those two. Brian Jordan is another. DJ Dozier is another. There's some 80s, 90s names, but just, it's not easy. Like, you are in, the top one half of 1%, or maybe even less, in the world at doing what you do, but you're doing both, not just one. It's astonishing. All right. Sunday. Pats, Rams.
Big game coming up.
Yeah, I know. For reals. We got a minute to talk about it. We got excited.
Well, those stats I sent you, the thing that jumped out at me, both teams are allowing less than 3 yards per rush in the playoffs. So that could be a story of which team can get a running game established. But offensively, the Pats are averaging 100 yards more per game passing than the Rams. So Pats passing game really hitting on all cylinders, and I think that'll be the difference. I got the Pats.
And we've talked about it too. Jared Goff working out of the play action has really been where he's successful. He is pedestrian if he's just a drop back guy. But if he has somebody else, and the fact that they just basically stumbled upon C.J. Anderson is fortunate. And he's fit in perfectly. And he and Todd Gurley, there's really no ego there. Like, Anderson's the old hand. He's won a Super Bowl. He knows what it takes. Gurley wants to win one. So, I like that. To me, that's what a team is all about. You might have some healthy competition, but at the end of the game, you're trying to accomplish the same thing. You're both trying to win for your team, because that's a part of your legacy too. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for the Rams, whether they're able to get anything going on offense, how the Patriots do not biting on any of those play actions and really making Goff more successful than he should be, because I still think, even for all of that, he is a system quarterback. I don't think Brady's the system quarterback, but I think Jared Goff is. So there are odds for the Super Bowl MVP. Ready?
Yeah.
Brady plus 125, Goff plus 250, Todd Gurley plus 1,000, Sony Michel plus 1,200, C.J. Anderson plus 1,600, Aaron Donald plus 1,800, James White plus 2,000, Julian Edelman also there, Gronk plus 3,000, Brandon Cooks plus 4,000. Would you go Brady plus 125?
I would. I'd go Brady and White.
There were also some interesting ones that popped up too. And I know Harry's going to be like, dude, you guys were over again. But
it's Super Bowl Sunday.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. We got to talk about it. This one flashed on the screen. The odds, if we're talking blank to one, Kyle Van Noy, 100 to 1. Stephon Gilmore, 100 to 1. Aaron Donald, 25 to 1. Corey Littleton, 100 to 1. Aqib Talib, 60 to 1. The field, all others, 20 to 1.
Well, definitely not Van Noy, since he's the one who didn't want to tackle on that miracle in Miami.
So I don't mind Brady at plus 125. I also think you could see a random, like, Sony Michel having a real solid game running the ball, getting a couple touchdowns. James White would be another one that I would see as a logical one. The wide receivers and the tight ends are tough. Like, it needs to be – that would require a more low-scoring game. And
Gronk to have two touchdowns.
And a critical play that kind of seals the deal. But I don't think this one's going to be low-scoring. So we will see. All right.
Lots to talk about next week.
Lots to talk. When don't we? our thanks to our producer, Harry Kozlowski, the rest of the crew here at the station, Colleen and Bill, my co-host, Andrew Hansen. Have a great sports week. Go Pats. We'll catch you next week. It's been a wonderful hour with you. Yeah. On Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.